This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is the last Friday in July. Time for our monthly journalist roundtable. And boy, do we have a busy month to rehash. As always, I'm joined by Dave Thompson, news director for Prairie Public in our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ashley.
In the Fargo studio with me, I have Dave Kolpak, a correspondent for the Associated Press. Dave, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Ashley.
We also have in Bismarck Hope Sisk, an anchor at KFYR-TV. Hope.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
And rounding out the conversation, Charles Crane, a reporter with the Minot Daily News. Charles, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Charles and Hope, you are both making your debut on Roundtable. Hope, let's start with you. Just a little bit about yourself. Introduce yourself to the Prairie Public audience.
I would love to, and thanks for the opportunity. I'm a longtime listener, so this is very exciting for me. I work at KFYR-TV. I recently became the assistant news director there. I'm a morning news anchor and lifestyle host there as well. I've been working in television news for 10 years now, and my first big job was in Fargo. So I am now a mom to two little girls.
All right. And Charles.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I'm a native of Mott, North Dakota, if any of you know the southwest corner. I spent some time studying broadcast journalism in Fargo and Moorhead, and then I wound up in the wilderness as a legal assistant and like a pharmacy clerk and a bunch of other things before Bob Patchen gave me a job here at the Minot Daily News earlier this year.
All right. Well, always want to be increasing the amount of journalists who are, well, frankly, still doing journalism across the state and joining us for Journalists Roundtable. We want to be starting today with the impacts of the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, this Supreme Court ruling that came out early this month. The most recent news on this is that a judge has put on hold the North Dakota trigger law that bans abortion. And Dave, there was an AP story about this.
Yes, and I think a few people were shocked a little bit at the judge's ruling just because, you know, North Dakota hasn't been real friendly to laws favoring abortion over the years. This was a motion for an injunction. You know, it really wasn't a big issue. It came down to two words, opinion versus judgment. They said the attorney general should have waited for the official judgment, which is something that they send to states, which is 25 days after, in this case, the opinion that, in essence, reversed Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you know, what it's done mainly is clarify what's happening here with the facility. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I found out that they were ready to move to Moorhead next week if they needed to.
Okay.
You know, we were all kind of in the dark there a little bit. And
rightly, this is Fargo's, this is North Dakota's only abortion provider.
Yep. And, you know, I understand why they were pretty close to the vest on that. There were security reasons and other reasons why. But the clarity is that, you know, they're ready to go within, you know, probably a month. Mm-hmm. They'll be over there providing services no matter what, and there will be no gap for women. And you know, it's only a matter of miles. That's a small consolation to people in North Dakota who would like to see abortion legal, and they're going to continue that fight. Mm-hmm. But in terms of services, it's that part of it will go smoothly.
Now, Charles, I know in particular that the Dakota Hope Clinic in Minot has been very active in its pro-life stance. It has brought in well-regarded pro-life speakers in to be talking about this issue in the months leading up to this decision. What kinds of stories are you covering, are you seeing out of Minot right now?
Well, in particular, when the leak first happened, there was a great deal of you know, uproar, especially from, you know, the youth. You know, surprisingly, a lot of high school activism happened. There was a couple different marches that occurred. But, I guess, unfortunately, there is just kind of this, you know, defeatism that was there from the beginning. And, As far as what could practically be done, all they really can do is point to the Red River Women's Clinic and look to support it any way they can.
I noticed a story on NPR's website today even that says with Roe overturned, doctors are seeing growing demand for sterilization procedures. And they focused on women who are in their 20s and 30s who are turning to these much more severe forms of birth control. In the newsrooms across the state here, has there been a conversation on the continuing coverage of, you know, the impacts and the kinds of conversations that will grow out of this? And Dave, why don't we start with you? Dave Thompson.
Our Dave, yes. There has been conversations. We've had discussions within our newsroom about this, and it's worth watching, and especially with the next legislative session coming up just around the corner, it seems, just a few months from now. Is there going to be an attempt to maybe put some more strings on North Dakota's abortion laws? Mm. I've been hearing from some legislators that they don't have the appetite for that right now because they think that the law is in good shape from their perspective, but you never can tell. Mm. You have a new legislative session, you have new legislators coming in. So that's what our focus is going to be.
Mm. I hope anything to add there.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, we will watch the next 30 days that would have started on Tuesday, given this most recent action from the judge, and we're watching the next developments that will be happening in our area. I think the biggest we anticipate will be continued protests around the Capitol as we see young people come out to do that. We were watching, especially over the 4th of July, we thought what would be a large gathering of people based on the interaction on social media turned out not to be overwhelming, but certainly couldn't be ignored nonetheless. So we'll watch how that impacts the next legislative session, too.
I do have one question that came to mind as we're having this discussion. The temporary restraining order only had to do with the 30-day clock. The other issue has not been decided yet, and that is whether or not abortion laws are unconstitutional because of North Dakota's constitution prohibiting any abrogation of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which I think is an interesting argument, but that has not been ruled on yet.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be.
I think there will be a lot of legal and philosophical debate. And this is a little bit unusual for Journalists Roundtable to take this conversation out of the newsrooms. But Hope, in particular, as another young woman and a mother such as myself, I'm wondering, anecdotally even, the conversations, have they been changing among your friends? I know that some of mine have raised some concerns about what will this mean for even things like the different kinds of birth control options, whether they block implantation or block fertilization, and how a ruling on seemingly on just abortion could impact birth control options down the line.
That's interesting, too. And I think it does speak to the article that you mentioned from NPR talking about these drastic measures that some people are looking to take if they feel their access to safe abortion care is no longer available to them. So it does bring to mind, what other measures is a person legally able to take? And then what ethical issues do we have along that as well? We'll be watching for that, too.
This is our July Journalists Roundtable discussion. As always, we have news director Dave Thompson. We also have special guest Dave Kolpak, a correspondent for the Associated Press, Hope Sisk, the assistant news director and an anchor at KFYR-TV, and Charles Crane, a reporter with the Minot Daily News. I also want to be focusing today on a couple stories that have come out about the Attorney General office and some emails here. Now, this goes back to the late Wayne Stengem dying while holding office, and then some stories here, Dave Thompson, that you have written about what happened to his email account. And both Daves have actually written pretty extensively on this. We'll start with PrayPublic, Dave.
Well, it's interesting because Liz Brocker, who was Wayne Stengem's assistant, is the one who said, we need to get rid of the emails. And she made an unfortunate comment that we want to prevent people from asking through Freedom of Information for what's in the emails. Now, that's probably been a sticking point among a lot of journalists. But it is interesting that you got people from both parties and some people outside the media who are calling for independent investigations. As a matter of fact, two Democrats held a press conference this week, and one, and that was Joan Heckman, the Senate Minority Leader, actually said the governor should probably call an investigation. Well, Drew Wrigley says his office is looking into the matter, and so far he said he has not found any violation of state law in terms of emails. And if that is the case, then there might have to be some tightening up of, you know, records laws that might have to happen in the next legislative session.
Yeah, what is the standard procedure for if someone who is a member of an elected office does pass away? Is the account usually automatically deleted? Is it usually held for a year?
And that's where – and I'm sorry. I will go into the weeds for just a few minutes on this because I've been thinking about this a lot and talking to people. Every agency and every branch of government has different rules. There's no one size fits all for the state. Well, if the state wants to or the legislature wants to pass a one size fits all, here is one particular issue that might come up. I'm just going to raise this. The legislature has broken away from the state's IT system and wants its own IT system. Each agency is headed by an elected official, elected separate from the governor. So they have their own procedures. Then you have the court system that has its own procedures. Crafting an umbrella law might be a real challenge. That's just my thought about that. And that's all I'm throwing out there as fodder for discussion.
Yeah. Dave Kolpak, you also contributed an article to this because I noticed on the most recent article that Dave Thompson put out focusing on Democratic senators who are calling for this investigation. But really, Dave Kolpak, this is bipartisan that people are really questioning this decision.
Right. And I think that's what really put this story over the top when you've got key Republican leaders saying we've got to look at this too. Mm-hmm. I mean I agree with Dave about Liz Brocker's unfortunate statement. I mean, this is the office that is responsible, you know, for making sure these records are kept. Open records, open meetings, that's you know, that takes up most of their time. And, you know, I'm not if Drew Wrigley said he can't find a legal basis here for any wrongdoing, well, there ought to be basis for it. I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer to me that these, you know, you delete documents the day after his death.
Yeah.
I mean, it just raises too many questions. You know, and I do give Drew credit because he did, I think he thoroughly went through the emails and sent out emails that were also, that also went through IT. And you got the feeling through that IT didn't really like keeping these documents either. So I would totally favor an independent investigation here.
Do we think that this will have an impact on Drew Wrigley and his reputation? He's not the one who deleted the emails, but could this impact his reputation?
I mean, he's kind of been the heir apparent to governor for quite a while in the Republican Party. And, you know, he's held several big jobs in law enforcement. You know, we'll see. I mean, he's had a pretty loaded month here.
You know, he's been busy.
Yeah. There's been the ballot fraud. There's been this. There's been the abortion ruling, which, you know, he got wrong there on a technicality. But, you know, I think in the long run, I think, you know, he's a guy that is really charismatic. And, you know, I think he tries to deal with people as best he can. So, I don't know how it'll affect his reputation. I guess we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Hope or Charles, do you have anything to add here?
It has been interesting to just follow this story just because from the top down in this country, you know, information retention seems to be a problem, you know, not to, you know, to throw any attention at like Secret Service texts or whatnot, but it has always been fascinating to see how these things we assume are built into the system aren't even there half the time. And it would be nice if they actually existed in a concrete way that was actually enforceable.
And I think to watch the reaction to transparency of a government agency, I think that's a sensitive topic for a lot of Americans right now, a lot of North Dakotans too, and to watch the bipartisan reaction to this story and the development of it, to see that the most important thing, it appears to me, to hear mostly from the general public is to believe there's transparency in the agency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for someone to say we want to prevent a Freedom of Information request. Yeah. Dave Kolpak, you mentioned also on the Attorney General's agenda recently has been this possible fraud for a ballot item. And there has been, you've written about this for the AP, an investigation into potential fraud. This is signatures for a failed ballot initiative regarding term limits.
Right. You know, the Secretary of State had at first, you know, in his ruling had picked out basically all the things they did wrong, and the list was pretty amazing. I mean, it just seemed like pretty basic things that you would get when you're trying to collect signatures. But
do we end up with a bunch of Mickey and Minnie Mouses here? What are you talking?
Exactly. I mean, and there's kind of been there's been a little bit of history here. I know that we had an issue a few years back where a bunch of football players, and I won't identify their college since I went to the University of North Dakota, but they were out helping to gather signatures, and turned out that ballot got refused as well. And but I think this is there is going to be charges here, which will be rare and interesting.
What is the precedent for charges on ballot fraud here?
Yeah, I don't, you know, there isn't that I can see.
Yeah. I am curious. I feel like I have noticed a growing number of people just on the streets approaching me. It even happened at a recent farmers market event that I was at, that people were there and gathering signatures. I'm just curious, do any of you feel like you have just noticed a lot more people out there gathering signatures, or am I just finally getting out of the house more?
Well, I can say that I've noticed a lot, and they always come up and they're say, "Would you sign this?" I don't sign.
No,
I don't sign. I am a reporter. I just have decided no. Although I have the right to do so, I just think it looks bad if you're going to sign a petition. The petition just puts something on the ballot. It doesn't mean you necessarily support it, but you support the right to get it on the ballot. But, you know, the way things are right now, and as suspicious as everybody seems to be of everybody else, and that could be a long discussion for another day, it is best to use some kind of caution when you sign petitions.
Yeah.
It's interesting to watch these, too, knowing that these citizen initiatives are basically the power that voters have to put forward a constitutional amendment or a proposed law or something like that. So it's interesting to watch what consequences will come out of these situations. And also, if it is in fact true that there's more people out there trying to get people to sign petitions, maybe it just signals more interest in getting involved in your local government. It's a politically heavy time. So I wonder if that's part of it.
Well, yeah, in hearing each of you just talk about an increased number of protesters going out and then maybe this anecdotal increase in people looking for ballot signatures, and then this even going back to this idea of transparency in government, and we want to be able to trust that these lawmakers are doing what they have been elected to do. And then we have this story from Minnesota where a lawmaker seems to have accidentally passed a law to legalize THC edibles. And now, boy, I tell you, the THC people were ready for this. There was a store open in Moorhead July 1st.
Is this Delta 9
this is
THC?
The Delta
or
9.
Is this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is the Delta 8, which isn't supposed to have the same impacts of, you know, marijuana as we know it. But then apparently it also did allow for the Delta 9, and that can cause the same chemical high of marijuana. And I am really curious to know, has anybody done more reporting on this since the sort of accidentally, perhaps anyway, we're going to use air quotes there, passing this? Because even in the rollout of these stores, it says, you know, 5 milligrams of hemp-derived THC, no more than 50 milligrams per package. But with a law that was rolled out that quickly, has there been the same level of scrutiny applied to this?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because there had been some discussion that I've heard the Minnesota legislature is still trying to get back into special session to decide what to do with their huge budget surplus. And some legislators I have had a chance to interact with have said that maybe they're going to have to take a look at this THC law and put some more strings on it. I've got strings in my mind today. I don't know. I've been listening to too many violin concertos. But they want to put things around it to prevent it from getting into the wrong hands, so to speak. People under the age of 21, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that, I think, is being talked about. And it would not surprise me if there's a special session. And I'm not saying that they're going to get one called, because there's still a lot of argument about what do you do with that surplus money, that there might be something. It might be something.
You know, the only related story I've been working on lately is there's a man from Bismarck who is building structures out of hemp, a product called Hempcrete, and he's building his first house right outside the studio here, only a few blocks away.
Okay.
You know, our Minnesota people have been handling that other story, but, you know, hey, Moorhead needs business, so I'm all for it.
Well, Dave Kolbeck, you and I are the ones on the border here. Have you heard anything about, you know, cops on the Fargo side just right at, you know, Main Avenue, First Avenue, the interstate as we cross over, people checking cars? Are you loading up in Moorhead?
No, I haven't. You know, is it illegal to buy it in Moorhead and bring it to Fargo?
It's not legal to have in North Dakota. Right?
Okay.
It's kind of a gray area, actually.
Yeah. Okay. Does anybody
It's kind of gray. I actually did a story on a local business owner who, you know, has what you would classify traditionally as a smoke shop.
Okay.
But he does have a number of these, you know, Delta variant products. And he actually, you know, spoke with local law enforcement very soon after he started rolling them out, you know, explaining to them differences between what they thought it was and what it actually was.
Mm.
And it doesn't seem to be an issue, you know, at least here in Minot, from what I can understand.
Okay. Well, I know, you know, Washington, it's legal recreational, and Oregon, it's legal recreational, but you can't bring any from Oregon into Washington, even though it's legal in both states. So, it's really interesting when it becomes, you know, the states making their own rules instead of a federal approach to something.
And when we watch North Dakota lawmakers go through the process of implementing the medical marijuana that passed in the state, how careful they appear to be with the language in that legislation. Now I imagine Dave Thompson what would be the reaction of lawmakers watching this, just shaking their heads?
Good question.
I think you're probably right. Yeah. Of course, we have I think it's been certified for the ballot, the Recreational Marijuana Initiative in North Dakota. How does that impact everything now? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things at play here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, recreational marijuana passed in South Dakota, and it's been a real disaster ever since. I don't even think they're up and running yet with that. So
I believe it was ruled unconstitutional, actually, by their Supreme Court. So I think it got struck down.
It will be an interesting story to continue to follow. It is our July Journalists Roundtable with News Director Dave Thompson and Dave Kolbeck, a correspondent for the Associated Press, Hope Sisk, the Assistant News Director at KFYR, and Charles Crane, a reporter with the Minot Daily News. We will be back with more of this conversation after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Is the United States in a recession?
I don't think we should be as concerned with whether we meet some ill-defined term like recession, we should be sitting there saying there are issues in the economy and they need addressed.
UND economist David Flynn says a big issue is inflation. He says the fact that prices are rising and at the pace they're rising is a problem.
We can get a headline number of inflation that says 7, 8, 9%. Whatever that number is, it's an aggregate. Not everything rises by the same rate. And when you confront those kinds of decisions, you have less than great information, and consumers don't know how to allocate their paycheck appropriately anymore because the relative values of these different things, the different things they buy, are suddenly off.
Flynn says you can add supply chain issues to that. As to the Federal Reserve's effort to control inflation by raising interest rates, Flynn says we should not view that as focusing on the inflation right now, but rather it's about future inflation.
They are sitting there resigned to the fact that inflation is way beyond what they are comfortable with and currently doesn't look like it's going to quickly come back into line with what they would like, and their concern is solely maintaining credibility as inflation-fighting policymakers going forward.
And a return to hot weather. The National Weather Service says it begins today with temperatures in the 80s, but Bismarck meteorologist James Telkin says it really starts to warm up tomorrow with 90s predicted.
There'll be a little bit of a cool down again Sunday, actually, as we have a little bit of a trough that comes through. But that's more for like northern North Dakota will be in the upper 70s, or the south will still be upper 80s to near 90 in some spots. But then for next week, it really gets hot. Monday, high in the 90s, especially, you know, the western half of the state, mid-90s in the southwest. Tuesday is the hottest day of the upcoming week, where pretty much everywhere in the state, except maybe the far north and, you know, northeast, will be in the 90s. Could even see a few hundreds, especially in the Bismarck area or south central. Maybe to the southwest, you could see some 100-degree readings.
Telkin says there are slight chances of precipitation during that stretch. By next weekend, temperatures will likely be in the 80s again. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the recipients of the 2022 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2022 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
Billy Russo is essential to the Chicago White Sox. He's the team's interpreter. What if a player yells at an umpire in Spanish using choice words?
If we say that, yes, I have to. I try to not add or take anything from what the players are saying.
Also a Chinese rocket falling back to Earth, but where? Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is our July Journalists Roundtable. We have our special guests, Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson. We have Dave Kolpak with the Associated Press, Hope Sisk with KFYR-TV in Bismarck, and Charles Crane with the Minot Daily News. And Charles, you sent a story about Protect North Dakota Kids. This is a Facebook group that has come under some scrutiny lately. Give us the latest on who this group is and who has a problem with them.
Yeah, they kind of cropped up at the beginning of June, obviously being Pride Month, where, you know, like all of the, you know, celebrating and memorials take place around the country. And amongst those is, you know, often fundraisers. And mm-hmm. some of them have been all ages drag shows. And this page popped up and started sharing identifying information about the drag queen performers, and that kind of caused a flame war back and forth between this page and the drag queens and the organizers.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard of an all-agers drag show. That's usually more 21 and up.
One would think, and that's kind of the rationale for making it all ages. The organizers, you know, deeply want to reach LGBTQ youth and give them awareness of support and, you know, community. And that is exactly why this page seems to have taken issue with them.
So is there some reaction from, you know, parents and stuff too, or is it mostly just these people?
There was some community contact with the organizers. Stacy Sturm specifically organized the event in Bismarck. She owns URL Radio.
Okay.
And she spoke with the community, you know, because this page riled people up initially. But there's a religious bent to the page that really turned people off from really associating with them and buying into what their mission seemed to be.
And what is their mission?
And that is, you know, kind of vague. It's, you know, laden with Bible quotes. The main organizer is a gentleman out of Washburn named Keith Hapeep Jr. And it seems to, you know, just, you know, simply be that they are opposed to the lifestyle and, you know, promoting it to children, or at least affirming it, you know, within, you know, children and teenagers.
They're calling it propaganda.
Yeah, they're calling it grooming, basically, those kinds of allegations.
Yeah, and people have told me the website's quite homophobic in a lot
of its
postings. And, you know, I don't know. I guess if you're a parent and you don't want your kids to go, don't let them go. But, you know, it's entertainment. I kind of enjoy that kind of entertainment myself, so.
Yeah, my girlfriend and I watch RuPaul's Drag Race.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the performers, you know, Kiera Fiera, that was kind of her take on it. It's like we tailor our performance to the audience. If there are children, we will, like, you know, leave certain items, you know, out of it. We won't disrobe nearly as much, that kind of thing.
Right.
Charles, you talked in your reporting about the targeting of the organizer of the event, Stacey Sturm, with that group. I thought it was so interesting to read in your reporting and also watch on social media the sort of groundswell of support against her. And she said, too, I believe, to you that she felt behind that Facebook page. We all can hide on social media. Behind it was probably far fewer people than you would have thought, the amount of people who are trying to defend her or defend the action of holding these types of events for people of all ages was far greater.
Oh yeah. If you, you know, just kind of peruse the comment sections, you know, do so at your, you know, you do so cautiously because it's kind of rough in there, but, you know, 10 to 1, it's people in support of the drag queens and, you know, vilifying the page and, you know, you kind of, you know, and a lot of engagement that is productive, lots of like genuine attempts at discussion even, but very little genuine support for what the page represents.
I want to switch focus now, talking about redistricting. The state has renewed a request to toss a lawsuit over redistricting. And Dave Kolpak, you wrote about this.
Yes. Local federal judge Peter Welty has said that this lawsuit has no basis to it, but, you know, they're going to give it another shot. And, you know, with the Republican...
And this is creating subdivisions.
Yes, correct. And the tribes have, you know, argued that this is really going to throw their ability to vote into a real tizzy. And, you know, I don't see the case going to trial. That's just my feeling, but... You know, Dave can probably help me here. We do have a Republican-controlled legislature, and, you know, they've really seemed to manage these voting districts.
Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. And the testimony during the session, the redistricting session, was that the two reservations that were split into different sub-districts for the House, it was a population thing, and also – there is some census law in other states that you should not do anything to disadvantage native voting or voting of any minorities. So they came up with a sub-district idea, and it's interesting because it was on Turtle Mountain, and it was also on three affiliated, Fort Berthold. And it appears there was a lot of support on Fort Berthold for it. And then other tribal leaders came out, and they were asking for the same thing. But the population, because it's one person, one vote, that's the concept, that they didn't have the population to support sub-districts. That's what happened down in Standing Rock, because you had to have – I think the number was around 15,000 or 15,500. Standing Rock had about 12,300, so they didn't have the population to do sub-districts. This whole thing is very interesting, and I wonder – where we're going with this. I really
that was my next question.
It probably won't be done before the election this year. So that is another situation that could be. This is not an easy subject because of the population requirements and then the idea that you should not disadvantage minority or native populations.
Right. There are some real issues to voting even now in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the judge in that case is really urging them to come to a resolution, but we'll see where that goes.
This story a little bit out of our actual region, and that's why I'm including it here. The Pope apologizing for catastrophic school policy in Canada. This goes back to a time when missionaries, when nuns, when priests were trying to Christianize the indigenous people of this land, and oftentimes using tactics that are horrendous. There were beatings, there were rapings, there were murder. There have been a number of stories of uncovered mass graves in the recent news. I think it's interesting that the Pope is apologizing in Canada. Have we heard anything about what he is planning on saying in the United States, or this reaction that the same thing happened on this side?
You know, I haven't heard anything. Dave Kolpak, maybe you have.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. And that's really been a big topic in Minnesota and Wisconsin, especially with those Native American schools they had back then. And, you know, just recently they've found these mass graves, you know, behind a lot of these schools. And you're right. I don't see the difference. And but none of our I went and checked our AP archive today, and the U.S. has not been mentioned in any of this.
Well, I'm curious just to get a personal reaction here on the role of an apology. This is a lot longer. This is a long time ago that this happened. Why do you think, if you do think it's important to apologize? And Hope, why don't you go ahead and start with this?
Oof, I don't feel like I can give you a personal reaction to it from my position, but I can tell you that when we were doing our reporting over the Interior Department's investigation of the Indian boarding schools and the burial sites and all that, we were hearing from tribal leaders about how important it was to make those amends and how that ancestral trauma had been passed down from one generation to the next, although many of these schools were operating into as late as the 60s, 70s?
60s, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, you know, we certainly still have people who may have memories from those situations. But if not, it is a community that is deeply hurt by it. So without giving you a personal reaction to it, I'm watching that closely. Certainly interested.
Yeah, it will be an interesting story to continue to watch. We do have a couple of energy stories to talk about here in just a few minutes left. Dave Thompson, you had a story from PSC Chair Julie Fedorchek about investments in electric transmission and the impacts on the state's economy.
Right. Now, Julie Fedorchek's part of the advisory committee to what is called the Midwest Independent System Operator, MISO. MISO has announced $10 billion worth of transmission projects that they have approved. Xcel's got some power lines to do, and apparently there may be one that MDU and Otter Tail are going to cooperate on to get power where it's needed. And, of course, this comes in the results of the brownouts and blackouts and rolling blackouts that we had during last year, February, when they had the problem in Texas. So they want to get – there's a couple prongs here. Number one, to beef up the security of transmission and the availability of power, but also to allow more renewable sources, wind, solar, and that type of thing, to get on the grid as well. So they need a lot more transmission, and it's not going to be overnight that this is going to happen. This $10 billion is going to probably take 10 to 12 years perhaps for it to come to fruition, because there's a lot of steps. The approval by the regional transmission operator is one. Then they have to go through FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Then they have to go through landowners and regulators in each state. So there's a process, but they're pretty confident that this is going to be one wave of the future.
Dave, one argument I've heard from people who may not be the biggest fans of electric cars is that, you know, the development of those cars, can the grid handle that?
That's a very good question. I've heard that same thing, too.
And, you know, I don't know if you've bought your Tesla yet, but
Public radio
money. Yeah, with public radio money. Can I fill up my scooter? No. Just kidding.
We have about 90 seconds left. Charles, you're in Minot. The state fair is in Minot. Just curious if you have seen any kind of a pandemic effect on, you know, how people are celebrating for the state fair.
You would think it was 2019.
Yeah.
You know, the crowds are thick, and I think I saw maybe 5 masks in the 5 days that I spent walking around the Midway and going to different exhibits.
No one's afraid of that. Or monkeypox, which has shown up in the state. Yeah.
And I spoke with the general manager, Renee Korslein, this morning, and she said that there's a lot more Canadian dollars flowing through than last year. So a lot more border crossings than we had from Canada.
Well, it has gotten a little easier to cross the border.
It was
difficult for the past couple of years. Well, that will have to do it for today. News Director Dave Thompson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley.
We also have Dave Kolpak, a correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Hope Sisk, the Assistant News Director and an anchor at KFYR-TV in Bismarck. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
And Charles Crane, a reporter with Minot Daily News. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And Charles and Hope, I do hope that you can continue to join us for Journalist Roundtable in the future.
Absolutely.
It would be fun.
Madeline is next.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
On The Great American Recipe.
Competition is definitely getting stiff. There's only 5 of us left. This week we're going to mix it up a little bit.
Oh my God.
This is definitely not a normal challenge.
They're out of their comfort zone and we're going to get to see who can shine.
This is wild.
Watch The Great American Recipe tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
There's the fanfare. That means it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. Matt, you've seen the latest from Jordan Peele, who, at least if you look at the Academy Award nominations for the last few years, is really having quite a successful run. The latest movie called Nope.
It's the worst of his 3 films.
Oh, no.
It's not even close. I loved Get Out. I loved Us. I felt Nope was underwhelming, and I'll explain exactly what I'm talking about. It's not a bad film. The special effects are great. The flying saucer science fiction special effects are great. And the reviews are all over the place on this movie. In the end, I just didn't see what the point was. You know, what's the movie about? And when I saw the various trailers that were released, I remember thinking to myself, I'm not sure what this movie's about. Now, maybe that was on purpose, but in the end, I'm not sure if this is a Western, a science fiction film, a horror film, a comedy film. I think it's a lot of films cobbled together, and it just did not, in the end, work for me on a lot of levels. It's an interesting movie. It's the biggest budget he's ever had, but if you've seen the trailer, you know this is about a brother and sister who run a horse ranch, and they train horses for Hollywood films and commercials and things like that. And they're experiencing weird things that are happening at the ranch, and they start investigating it. Let me give you one example of what I didn't think worked. There's a side plot involving Steven Yeun from Walking Dead and Minari fame, and he plays this grown-up former child actor who kind of contractually buys a horse from Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer. They're the brother and sister who run the ranch. And you keep thinking this side plot is going to develop into something because the opening shot of the movie is a shot from the sitcom he was on as a child. And it involves a chimpanzee, things like this. And you're kind of just waiting, like, is this going to tie in at some point? And we do revisit that, but it never quite ties together. Like, why is that the first shot of the movie? That was one thing. It almost felt like a David Lynch type situation where you see those things in David Lynch films. And a couple other things, you know, when in the trailer you see that they want the money shot. They got to get the money shot of this flying saucer and whatnot. And when that big reveal finally comes, my reaction was, they're not going to get paid for that money shot. It's you know, you can doctor all kinds of images. So the payoff for this movie just wasn't there for me. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting movie. I think Daniel Kaluuya underplays his part really, really extensively, to the point where I think it was almost underplayed too much. Kiki Palmer's very entertaining as the sister. But overall, it's not a bad film. Some people are calling it a bad film. That is not the case at all. It's just we've expected the bar being very high now with Get Out and Us, and it did not do as well at the box office as Us did when Us debuted with its opening weekend.
Does it give away any plot points if I ask you why is it called Nope?
Daniel Kaluuya says that word a few times. That's about all I can say.
Okay.
It's not happening. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Okay.
I would say this too. Peele, you know, maybe the third time out he's trying to top himself, and maybe he works better under a small budget. That could be what's going on. You know, at times it feels like a Spielberg movie, you know, Close Encounters. It feels like an M. Night Shyamalan film. It feels like a David Lynch film. So there's a lot of homages going on, okay, I think, to people that Jordan Peele admires. But because of that, it doesn't really feel like a Jordan Peele movie, like we're used to with Get Out and Us. Not that he has to repeat himself constantly. I just think this is the weakest of his three movies.
Does it
three
seem
movies.
To have any Oscar legs in any of the kind of
special effects?
Categories?
Other than that, I don't think it's going to have Oscar legs. What's really going to be interesting, Ashley, is this weekend will be its second weekend. Will the word of mouth, and I, you know, the word of mouth with my friends is a little bit underwhelming. Will word of mouth drop the box office far lower than the $44 million it opened at? And that, let me be very frank, that's a great opening for an original screenplay. This is not based on a Marvel comic, a book, anything. So give Peele credit for having original ideas. But we'll see. If the word of mouth on this movie isn't great, the box office could slump this weekend.
Okay. Well, Jordan Peele did get an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for Get Out, the first black person to get that award. Who is the first African-American to win an Oscar for Best Documentary?
Wow. So directing a documentary. That's a good question today, Ashley. I don't think it's Spike Lee.
No,
but he did some documentary shorts, I know, and a
it
feature
is
as well.
A documentary about a football team in Memphis.
Oh, yeah. Who directed that? I'm going to give up. Sorry.
T.J. Martin.
T.J. Martin, okay.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Oling.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Cottonwood Bluegrass Band invites you to the 10th Annual Bluegrass Goes Pink, a fundraiser benefiting the Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation on Saturday, July 30th at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn. You can start your morning with a fun 5 or 10K walk or run on the scenic trails of Cross Ranch. Then supper will be served by the Washburn Churches at 5 and a concert by Cottonwood Bluegrass Band at 7 p.m. Wear pink and enjoy some bluegrass and support cancer awareness with Bluegrass Goes Pink, July 30th. More information online at cottonwoodbluegrass.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 28th. Eldon Wayne Jers was born in 1944 to Henry and Catherine Jers and raised in Hazen, North Dakota. Eldon's father was a baker, and the family lived near the bakery in a small house along an alley. Eldon graduated from Hazen High School in 1962 from the old brick three-story building where all the grades were together. He went to college at NDSU, finishing in 1966 with an ROTC commission. Then he entered the U.S. Air Force, becoming a jet pilot. During the Vietnam War, he flew the F-105 Thunder Chief fighter bomber. Eldon rose through the ranks and held many positions, including instructor for the T-38 Talon and the SR-71 Blackbird. While in the Air Force, Eldon received a master's degree from Auburn University in Alabama. He went on to command the 410th Bomb Wing of the 8th Air Force from May 1987 to May 1989. He also led the Strategic Air Command's 307th and 46th Air Refueling Squadrons and the 644th Bombardment Squadron. On this date in 1976, Eldon broke the all-time speed record for manned air-breathing jet engine aircraft, flying the SR-71 Blackbird, Lockheed's high-altitude surveillance jet. The conditions on this day happened to be perfect for taking the aircraft to its limit. Eldon pushed the jet up to 2,193 miles an hour, which is more than three times the speed of sound, reaching an altitude of over 80,000 feet. Faster than a rifle bullet, the extreme speed heated the cockpit window to 622 degrees, despite an air temperature at that altitude of 67 below. The SR-71 Eldon flew that day is now on permanent display at the Robins Air Force Base Museum near Macon, Georgia. Eldon retired from the Air Force in 1997 at the rank of Major General. The record that Eldon broke still stands today, more than 45 years later. This Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Marie Offutt.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, it's another 10 Things episode with Clay Jenkinson and Lindsay Cherfinski. And Clay, this one's a little different.
A listener sent me a letter asking us to wrestle with some of the paradoxes and inconsistencies of Jefferson's life, of course, chiefly the problem of slavery and Thomas Jefferson.
He also asked why a guy like Jefferson, who kept such meticulous records, could never get his own personal finances under control.
He reduced the national debt by about half, but he wasn't able to manage his private finances, and as we all know, Jefferson died helplessly in debt.
Lindsay Cherfinski has a very interesting perspective on these things.
Not particularly enamored of our favorite man, Mr. Jefferson, and willing to speak to some of the paradoxes that have been glided over by previous historians.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, going to Sioux Falls. That used to be code for getting a divorce. We visit with the author of The Divorce Colony, How Women Revolutionized Marriage and Found Freedom on the American Frontier. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.